Studios of WISR, I'm Pat Parker reporting. Next Year Bank, your hometown community bank, committed to the community, committed to you.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
On the Monday edition of It's Your Turn, the frigid Monday edition of It's Your Turn, Veterans Day observed today. And it's really kind of nice we get to celebrate Veterans Day twice. Yesterday was actually Veterans Day, but the governmental observance is today. The big parade in downtown Butler was a couple of hours ago. And happy Veterans Day. And thank you to all of our veterans today. We have guests in us in the studio with us for the first portion of the program today. We have several other guests we're going to be chatting with on the telephone today on the It's Your Turn program. Let me tell you a little bit about what's coming up later. We're going to be chatting with Gina LaRoche, who has an interesting subject. She thinks that we would be far better off as a society if we cultivated a life of sustainable abundance. In other words, do we have enough stuff? And if we do, why are we constantly striving to get more stuff? So we'll talk about that with Gina LaRoche. And also on the program today, most appropriate, I think, for Veterans Day, we'll talk about the history of the Statue of Liberty. Edward Berenson will be chatting about that. Many of our service personnel, men and women who served overseas, particularly in World War II, sailed past the Statue of Liberty whenever they were being deployed. Because back in those days, most people were deployed by ship, not by plane. So we'll talk about that. The Statue of Liberty, I think most folks would know, comes from France, from the people of France. But we'll tell you a little bit about the history of it, or rather, Edward Berenson will, later on the program today. But first, we welcome three young adults, students all, from Butler County Community College. They're gearing up for the Pioneer Players production of a play this weekend called Bleeding Facade. Let's introduce our guests first of all. Gabrielle Barton is here. Gabrielle, nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You're the author of this play.
Yes.
We don't very often get to talk with the playwright herself when we're talking about an upcoming production. We'll be anxious to talk about how you came to write this. Also with us are two members of the cast, Victoria Allen. Victoria, nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
And also William Lucas Franklin. Lucas, good to have you here as well.
Thanks for having me.
So let me go back to Gabrielle here. Bleeding Facade is the name of the play.
Yes.
And it's on the boards this weekend. What are the dates and so on?
So it's debuting November 15th, 16th, and 17th. So Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. The 15th and 16th, it'll be at 7:30 in the evening, and then the 17th, that Saturday, is a matinee at 2.
So three performances this coming week, actually the end of this week and into the weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bleeding Facade. Sounds a little bit scary. How would you describe this play?
Well, it's a murder mystery.
Oh, okay. Now I get it.
So there you go.
Bleeding Facade. Yeah.
Yeah.
Murder mystery. Are you a fan of murder mysteries, Gabrielle?
I actually don't have that big of a repertoire to like pull from murder mysteries, but the first play I ever helped with was a murder mystery. So I guess that's kind of just come through in that way. But I guess the ideas just always interested me.
It's a little unusual, and I don't know, Victoria or Lucas, whether you've been involved in other plays at BC3, but it's pretty unusual to have a student be the playwright, don't you think, Lucas?
Yeah, it's very uncommon. This is actually the,
only the second show I've worked on where I've met the author of it. Like, every other time has just been, you know, people finding a show that seems good and putting it on. But, yeah, it was really...
That's very unusual that you even done it before. When did that occur?
I actually... Oh, it's been a while. It was the summer after I graduated high school.
Mm-hmm.
It was with Freeport Theater Festival, and we did a play called The Spirit of St. Mary's, which was, like, it was in honor of the 190th anniversary for St. Mary's Church in Freeport.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's the only other time that I did it.
It's Mr. Steele down there, right?
Yes.
I think he's the guy who probably wrote that, because he writes some of their plays.
Yeah, he wrote it, and I think his wife also helped with it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
His wife's a very good actress. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit with Victoria Allen here. She's one of the cast members of this murder mystery, Bleeding Facade. What character do you play, Victoria?
I play Casey Holland. She is the secretary to the lead investigator.
So, obviously, there are police involved in investigating this whole murder mystery thing.
Correct, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit, Gabrielle, about the play itself. Obviously, we're not going to reveal the denouement. Did the butler do it? You have to go and find out, but set the stage for us a little bit here.
So it takes place November 14th, 1996. No particular reason for the date. It just worked out. I just liked it. And there's this mayor in an unknown or unnamed city. His name is Charles Murray, and he invites 7 individuals to his house.
Mm-hmm.
Under the guise of it being a charity event that he has been working on for the past 5 years. The reason that he has invited these specific people is because he believes one of them is about to make an attempt on his life, which is why he invites the detective Nathaniel Reed and Casey to help solve the case before something happens.
So they're also invited to the affair. Is this a affair? Is it a fundraiser, a party? What's the guise that he gets them all there?
So he starts this event to help, like, clean the streets of crime, and he's been working on it for 5 years, and so he's very proud of this, and he wants to kind of show off all of the accomplishments that he's had as mayor of this city.
Mm-hmm. And this is set somewhere in the United States?
Yes, somewhere in the northeastern region.
Mm-hmm. Large city? Fairly large.
Up to interpretation, I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm. This is set in 1996.
Yes.
You wouldn't even have been born yet in 1996. Why did you pick that particular year?
I really liked the, like, aesthetics of the 90s. Mm-hmm. There's also just a lot to kind of look back and research, but it wasn't too far back, because when it comes to, like, plays, I'm very much aware of how difficult it is to get period clothing or period sets. So this one, it was a lot easier to kind of have a lot of stress be taken off cast and crew for getting a set together and costumes and makeup and hair.
That's a good reason. Yeah, very good. If you're going to get it produced, you want to make it easy enough that people can do it. Lucas, what about you? You're also part of the play, a cast member. What part do you play?
I play Thomas, who is a lawyer. He is specifically a defense attorney, and he is just all around a really great guy. He's known for only accepting cases where he believes that they are innocent, and he wants to help people, you know, just clear their names whenever they deserve it.
People invited to a guy's house under mysterious circumstances. I'm thinking of, you know, Agatha Christie's play 10 Little Indians, Gabriel.
I'm slightly familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading a brief synopsis of it, and I remember, like, the whole thing is just a wild ride where people just start disappearing.
Yeah,
for
they
no
start.
Reason.
Does that happen in your play? Are people disappearing one by one?
No, there's okay. No disappearances.
That's good. So it's really concern about a murder that may happen in the future.
Let's put it this way: it's a murder mystery for a reason. So
okay, well, it's a mystery. So.
Yeah.
Your poster's intriguing. You brought one of your posters. It's got three playing cards. Mm-hmm. They're all queens, queen of hearts, queen of spades, queen of diamonds, with a dagger through the heart of the queen of spades. Is this just to catch people's attention, or does this have something to do with the play itself?
So the title, Bleeding Facade, when I was writing the play, there's like two specific scenes where there's cards involved. Mm-hmm. So I was looking up card terms when you play, you know, any sort of game. And bleeding is a term for being able to see another person's hand. And then facade, of course, is there's a guise, some sort of, you know, wall put up. So the idea is that you may be able to see everyone's cards, but that's not necessarily what's happening or who they are. So the three cards, I'm really big into symbolism. So each card represents at least three of the characters.
Okay. Did you design this poster?
I did.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Very nice. Very attractive. You know, I played cards. I did not know the term bleeding. It was a term about knowing somebody else's card. I thought that was cheating whenever you...
Also that.
But, I know, played a little poker, a little hearts, a little 500, that's about it. Maybe I wasn't playing the right... I'm glad I wasn't playing the right game if we're talking about this. The detective, and you're the assistant, administrative assistant for the detective, Victoria?
Correct, yes. Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about what you do. Are you this individual's right-hand assistant? Do you really do a lot of the work for him, like Archie Goodwin did for Nero Wolfe in that great series?
She, Casey, the two of them kind of have a really good partnership going on.
Uh-huh.
They divvy up the workload, but she's definitely more of a observer. In the sense that, like, she's not going to get just right into a case, just jump right into it. She's going to kind of take a step back and kind of observe and see, like, okay, this is what's going on. This is how I'm going to go about doing this.
Who plays the detective, do you know?
Christian? What's his last name?
Christian Sindrowski.
I can never say his last name.
Sindrowski.
This is not unusual when you're doing a play at school because, you know, you may not know some of the people unless you happen to have them in class or graduated with them or something
right.
like that.
We got to know each other. All of us got to know each other pretty good with this, at least in this cast. We've worked well together.
We've also been really fortunate because the past few plays that we've done, it's been really hard to get people's schedules to line up. But this one, a lot of people were able to meet at a very specific time. So, like, we didn't have that problem. So it was really, really lucky and really, like, stress relieving to have everyone, like, there for rehearsals.
This would be even more difficult, I should think, Lucas, because of the fact that Butler County Community College is not a residential school. None of the students stay on campus overnight, which is when you would ordinarily rehearse, you know, a show.
Yeah, that does make it pretty difficult because, Victoria and I, we live like half an hour away, so it's not the easiest to just stop by BC3 to work on stuff. Mm-hmm. And this weekend, we actually, the Saturday, to get a little more practice in to make sure that we had our lines down, I actually had the cast come over to my house, and some people weren't able to make it just because they live far away and people work. And yeah, it can get difficult after hours to meet up.
To say nothing of classwork, for goodness sakes. I mean, it's not like you stop school or stop any of your writing or your search work while you're doing a show.
Yeah.
Tough to squeeze it in.
Yeah, there's typically a period, like the week after a show's done, where you're just picking up the pace with schoolwork and getting everything done that you should have been getting done the past week.
You know, but, the feeling, yeah. Plus, there's a little bit of decompression time after you do a show as well. Kind of take a deep breath and come down a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued, Gabrielle Burton. First of all, are you directing this show?
Yes, I'm co-directing it with one of the advisors for Pioneer Players. His name is Michael Beck.
Oh, yes, I know Mike, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you wrote the darn thing. You're directing the darn thing. You're like a Barbara Streisand here. You're doing about. Are you in the show?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I've actually never acted before.
Really?
Yeah. I have massive stage fright, so it's really hard for me to get up the nerve to even attempt to audition for a show.
Have you written a play before this?
No, but I helped edit one. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was that you smiling? I was looking at Victoria when I asked about Archie Goodwin and Nero Wolfe. Have you ever heard of Nero Wolfe?
Yeah,
you
no.
Know who that? I thought I saw you smiling over there.
Yeah, my dad, like, I don't remember how he found the series, but, like, we bought the TV show, mm-hmm. and, like, I really liked how that's all set up. I really liked the characters. And then, like, you'll mention it, and no one else will know what it is, and I'm like, oh, it's such a good show. You should really watch it.
Lucas, Nero Wolfe, ring a bell?
I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
Victoria, Nero Wolfe?
I'm in the same boat as Lucas.
Written by a writer by the name of Rex Stout. Yeah. And he started writing these a long, long time ago. I discovered them accidentally when I was in undergraduate school, when I should have been studying. But, my brother, we both went to the same school, and he somehow latched onto this guy, and he said, you ought to read one of these books. So, of course, I immediately put down my other textbooks and started reading Nero Wolfe novels. There's like 90 of them. I mean, this guy was prolific, and they're all murder mysteries, which is why I brought it up to begin with. You know, Nero Wolfe was a portly detective who very seldom left his home. He lived in a brownstone in New York City, and he had an administrative assistant, a helper named Archie Goodwin, who did all the legwork for him. And, of course, Nero Wolfe would take all the credit. But Gabrielle has heard of him. Yeah, good for you. So do you have any dreams or intentions of trying to become a writer, make that a career, Gabrielle?
I would love to. For the longest time, I was really focused on, like, short stories and novels, and then I realized that I was struggling with that. Mm-hmm. And then my senior year of high school, they offered a screenwriting class, and I realized that it wasn't that I couldn't write, it was more the medium wasn't correct.
Ah.
So being able to write visually really helped, you know, refocus my attentions in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Where'd you go to high school?
Knoc.
And you had an opportunity to take a course like that in your senior year?
Mm-hmm.
What was the name of the course again?
I think it was just screenwriting.
Wow, that's terrific. That's pretty unusual to have that opportunity in high school. That's, you know, like an undergraduate course. You know?
Yeah, I was really fortunate with that. Mm. Yeah, I really enjoyed that class. And then from there, I've written a few, like, short things here and there. But I realized that my attentions are better focused in writing for either stage or screen.
Mm-hmm. But obviously you were writing in high school, probably even started in grade school or junior high, I imagine, huh?
Yeah, I remember being like 5 years old and like just writing stuff. It, of course, it wasn't correct spelling, but it was writing nevertheless. I just from a very early age, I wanted to be an author.
Well, I've talked to a lot of authors, and don't let that hold you back. I've talked with many authors who, very easily admit that they're not very good at grammar or punctuation, but they say, that's what an editor is for, you know. I come up with the story, and I let them go over it and fix it up. Did you ever write anything, Lucas? A play or a short story or anything?
Actually, recently, Gabrielle has gotten me into writing short stories and poetry.
Really?
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, she's the editor for Facets.
Yeah.
And so she just wanted me to write some things for that, and so I've been writing, like, a few poems and things like that.
Excellent. What's Facets?
Facets is BC3's literary magazine. But there's also like an art portion, but I'm an editor for the literature side of things.
How often is that published?
That's published, I think, yearly, annually. We publish it, I think, in the spring.
Is it actually physically published, or is it online only these days, you know, because a lot of things aren't actually published anymore?
I'm not entirely sure. I would have to ask Michael Dittman.
Who obviously, you're still putting it together for this year's edition.
But I'm not sure about that.
Well, Victoria, that leaves you and I. Have you ever written anything?
No, I'm much better on stage.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to Slippery Rock.
Mm-hmm. And what year are you at BC3?
This is my second year at BC3.
What are you majoring in? What's your principal area of study?
I'm actually a fine arts major with a focus in theater.
Fine arts and theater?
Yep.
Yeah. Some of our listeners may be surprised to learn that that's an available course of study at BC3. Fine arts, visual arts? I mean, do you paint and stuff like that? Or mainly performance arts?
Mainly performances.
Mm-hmm. So did you do any of this while you were in high school? Or have you done it with amateur groups or something like that?
I did a lot of stuff in high school. I did the musicals and stuff like that. I was in the band. So just anything with like music or acting was what I did.
Well, we wish you luck. That's not an easy career to break into, as I'm sure you've been counseled, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You not only need to be good, but you need to be lucky, too. You need to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
That same would hold true for you, Gabrielle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get a couple of breaks along the way.
I would consider this to be one of them. I almost wasn't at BC3, so I don't know if I would have been able to do this.
Really?
Yeah.
So tell us that backstory. You graduated from Nauk High School, and you almost went to the University of Alaska, or what happened?
Absolutely. No. So I actually did go to a different university my first year out of high school. I went to this very small university down in Roanoke, Virginia. So, but I didn't like it, so I decided to transfer, and initially I was going to transfer to Point Park.
Mm-hmm.
I got accepted to their cinematography program, but that kind of fell through last minute, and I was like, I don't know where else will take me this late in the game, and so I applied to BC3 on a whim, and here I am 2 years later.
Good for you.
Yeah.
It was a good move for you then, huh?
Yes, I'm very happy. I look back at the past 3 years, and I don't regret where I am and how I've gotten here.
Mentioned Professor Michael Dittman. I know he's an English professor at BC3. Is that what you're majoring in?
Yeah, I actually, when I first went to BC3, I was actually going to major in fine arts for theater, and then the English degree transfers better. There's a lot of schools in the area that will allow you to have the associates and still transfer instead of just taking the credits, which I was very much interested in.
Do you plan to pursue a four-year degree, or you're not sure yet?
I would like to. I've been accepted to IUP for one of their English degrees. It's like an English literature and cultural degree, which you can have a focus in film, which is what I really am interested in. But having that degree, from what I've researched, it allows you to have a background in English drama and film. So it combines like all three of my favorite things.
Well, I hope that works out for you. That would be terrific.
Thank you.
Most people that we talk to or hear about that are interested in the career in this area are looking at it from a performance standpoint. Victoria is a good example. But behind the scenes as a writer, that's pretty rare.
Yeah.
I have an acquaintance of mine, actually he's a pretty good friend of mine, who, this is quite some time ago now, probably 20 years, who decided he was going to write a play. And he had never seen a play in his life at that time. And he wrote a play and then a book, and he won the Drew Hines Prize. He was just, still is, a natural writer. That's what he was born to do. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Writing a play, and you'd never seen a play before, and it wins an award? Yeah.
I guess I never should have gotten into plays, guys. Just written it without seeing one.
His name is Randall Silvis, by the way, if you want to look him up. Randy Silvis. He's been at BC3. He's spoken there. In fact, that was the last time I saw him, I think. So, William, what about you? Are you second year at BC3, or what?
This is actually my third year, because originally I was going for my associates in psychology, but then halfway through last year, I decided that psychology isn't something that I want to do, even though I'm really interested in it, And now I switched it over to cybersecurity, and I'm at BC3 for another year. Just get a bunch of credits that will transfer over to my next college.
That sounds like something that might be very promising for a career. If you became an expert in cybersecurity, probably a lot of jobs there.
Yeah, last I checked, it is 0% unemployment. Mm-hmm. So it'll basically be me getting out of college and just walking into wherever and then getting a job.
Now, you've had to take, obviously, I changed majors too halfway through, so I know what you're going through. You have a whole bunch of other courses you've got to take to get your associate's degree that you wouldn't have had to take if you stayed in psychology. Do you plan to then transfer to a four-year school or get a full bachelor's?
Yes. I'm. In the end, I would like a bachelor's, and then
probably
also
make it easier to get a job.
Yeah, and then
in that field, I mean.
Yeah, and then also I want to get a bunch of certifications in different programming languages because, you know, they're a bunch of different ways that you can code the same thing. It's just that different languages are better for different things.
Hey, listen, you start talking code, baby, you've lost me. I'm still trying to learn how to use Windows 10. So if you're going to start coding, then good luck to you and the best of luck, but don't come to me for advice. That's marvelous. That's really wonderful. Well, if you're going to work in cybersecurity, obviously, you've got to know coding.
Yeah.
Good for you. That's terrific. Have you done a bunch of plays in the past, Lucas?
I have. I started getting into theater my freshman year of high school, but I started out in stage crew, and the only reason why I got into stage crew was because I knew that there were a couple cute actor girls, and so that's just why I joined it. And then I remember there was one day I walked on stage to ask the director a question, like what color he wanted something to be painted, and I saw all of the actors on stage in a pile pretending to kill each other, and I was like, that's what I want to do. That looks like so much fun.
Now, our young ladies, whenever you mentioned why you got involved, Lucas, they were laughing, see?
Yeah.
I'm with you. I know exactly where I know exactly what you're talking about.
I mean, from the opposite side of things, I mean, same.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because I got involved because of my significant other.
There you go, see? So,
yeah.
Not so funny after all, huh?
Yeah, it's still funny. I don't know.
Same thing happened to me. You're from Sarver. Did you go to Freeport you went to, right?
Yes.
Freeport. Mm-hmm. Well, they must have a pretty good theater program down there, too, then, huh?
Oh, yeah. Like, it was fantastic. The director there, I love him. He's great. Mr. Karachik, we called him K or Dad. If you went to district course, you're allowed to call him Dad. But it was just great. I'm really glad that I got to do all that.
Well, it sounds like all of you had good experiences in high school then, you know, whether it was Slippery Rock or Freeport or Knock. Prepared you well for higher education, huh? We mentioned some of the other people that are involved in the cast. The detective, are there any other principals that we should name?
So there's a 10-member cast, five male, five female. I would say that each character is important to the plot in some way. Mm-hmm. I intentionally made it so that no character is really a minor character.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone has like their moment that is very important to the plot. I think that if you were to take one out, it would kind of fall through and you would really have to rework the script. So like we have Thomas Powell, lawyer. We have Casey Holland, assistant to Nathaniel Reed, who's the detective. You have Charles Murray, who's the mayor. You have his brother James, and then James's wife Mary. They work at the local newspaper. There's Kimberly Simmons, who is an investigative journalist. She's up and coming. She wants her big break. There's Nicole Summers, who is a socialite. She's taking care of her late husband's business. And then there's two other characters who are the butler and maid for Charles, which is Elizabeth and Daniel Rogers. Mm-hmm. They're siblings.
Do you know some of the other student names that we could mention? People might know them and be interested in coming to see them.
I can run through all of them if you want.
Oh, please do. Yeah.
Okay, so just to cover all the bases, we have Victoria Allen as Casey Holland. We have William Lucas Franklin as Thomas Powell. Christian Sendrowski, who has been in a lot of local plays, so people will probably know him because he works very closely with Butler Little Theater. But Christian plays Nathaniel Reed. Steve, I think it's Beichner, he plays Charles. Eli Mittner plays James. Mickey Elmer or Mackenzie Elmer plays Mary. Kira Elder plays Elizabeth. Wolfgang Geiser plays Daniel. Paige Gressley plays Kimberly, and then Megan Hyatt plays Nicole.
Will tickets be available in advance or just at the box office or both? Do you know?
Both. The tickets are actually already available, but people are more than welcome to show up at the box office the days of. You can contact the box office at bc3.edu/suckup-theater, or the phone number, if I can give that, is 724-284-8505. And yeah, so if you would like tickets, you can purchase them early, or you can just stop on by.
Pioneer Players, production of A Bleeding Facade. I knew very well the first person who actually founded the Pioneer Players and then was the director for many years, the late Margot Pitts. Have you heard that name?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, she was an instructor at BC3. Taught psychology, as a matter of fact, at least one or two courses I know in psychology. She also did a program here on WISR, too, even while she was teaching. She was quite the Renaissance woman and very much involved in local theater. And she, of course, in the early days, before Suckup Theater was built, theater productions at BC3 were done in what is now Founders Hall. Used to be called the Convocation Center. There's a stage there, but that's about it. The seats are not raked, so, you know, kind of tough to see. And there's not a fly system there either, so you were pretty limited in what you could do. She would be beside herself with joy if she was able to bring the Pioneer Players on stage at Suckup Theater, because that's a full-fledged theater, so you're lucky to be able to work there. Yeah. Bleeding Facade, a play not only produced and featuring students at Butler County Community College, but written by a student at Butler County Community College, Gabrielle Barton, here with us today. And also William Lucas Franklin here, and Victoria Allen. How nice to have you all here. It was nice to meet you.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to meet you. And appreciate you coming in on a holiday. Are there classes today at BC3?
Yes, there are.
There are? Okay. Some schools are off today, some are, but I think it's mainly the public and parochial schools that have the day off. College students grind on, holidays or not. Well, anyway, Victoria, Gabrielle, Lucas, nice to have you here today. It really was a delight to talk to you.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Show dates, Thursday, Friday, Saturday of this week. Thursday and Friday evenings, and then the Saturdays are matinee, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking with our next guest, Gina LaRoche. Do we have enough stuff? Do we have enough stuff? Everybody seems to always want more, you know, whether it's a bigger house or bigger car or more stuff. Gina says, maybe we already have enough. So we'll talk about that with her. And then still later on the program today, appropriate, I think, for Veterans Day, the history of the Statue of Liberty. We'll be chatting with Edward Berenson about that. We'll take a break. Back with the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR right after these words.
If you're curious, the news informs you, but it also piques your curiosity. Enter The Context, a free weekday morning newsletter from PA Post. PA Post is the statewide nonprofit and nonpartisan news organization reporting on public policy issues in the state. The Context ties together compelling stories from across Pennsylvania with insight and perspective and points your curiosity in a meaningful direction. Start your subscription today at papost.org.
Hey, finished your homework yet?
Almost. What's on your laptop?
Oh, it's a site to help me talk with you about alcohol.
Is this going to take all night?
No. In fact, it says take it one subject at a time.
Why now?
Well, you're at the age where you need to know the facts about alcohol.
But I'm only 8.
It says that 1 in 3 kids have already tried alcohol by your age.
Really?
Talk with your kids about alcohol. Learn more at knowwhennowhow.org. A message from the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board.
Most appropriate, listeners, as we head into the Thanksgiving season and the holiday season, to talk with our next guest here on the It's Your Turn program on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey. We're chatting with Gina LaRoche. She is the co-author of a new book entitled The 7 Laws of Enough. Gina, nice to meet you. Boy, it's terrific to be able to chat with you for a few minutes here today.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to meet you, too.
So, The 7 Laws of Enough, subtitle of your book, Cultivating a Life of Sustainable Abundance. Can you give us a quick nutshell take on just what the overall message of The 7 Laws of Enough is about, Gina?
Sure. Well, I would say in a nutshell that you do enough, you have enough, and you are enough. And this book offers you a pathway from what we call a scarcity story to a life of sustainable abundance.
Hmm. Sustainable abundance. Just what do you mean by that, Gina?
Well, for us, we have very specific definition of what it means. So sustainable means for us ethical, reciprocal, and just. And abundant is... And abundance is really holding the full, radiant experience of life and being present to the bounty everywhere. And we always tie those words together because sustainability without abundance, oftentimes we get into this deep lack and what's missing, and abundance without sustainability can lead us to really spiritual materialism and wanting more than enough. So we always tie those words together to have this experience of sustainable abundance.
Well, you give us some steps, some very simple steps, actually, to help us see for ourselves that we often have enough even when we believe that we do not. And that's a pretty common perception, isn't it, in American society today? We don't think we have enough, right?
Right. I mean, one of the statistics I saw that over the last 20 years or so, last generation, we've gained 1,000 square footage in housing, and we've on average lost 5 friends. So not only have we shifted our relationship into the stuff domain, but also in the interpersonal and connection domain, where we tend to take our attention to what's that new pair of shoes or next car or next iPhone, rather than these interpersonal relationships that could have me have this sense of belonging, give me a sense of belonging at work and in our communities.
I have seen you go into many new housing plans here in our country these days, and you see these monster houses. Even for people who have kids, but especially for people who don't, you just have to ask why. You know, what's the purpose? Is it trying to show people that you have money? Why would you ever build a house that big to begin with? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then what I've found has been you never have people over to your house to experience your house. The other thing I notice in those communities is they all have these big garages. So you get in your car in your garage, you pull out, drive to wherever you're going, and then you come back in, you go right in your garage and shut the door. No one ever knows if you're home. You never get an opportunity just to catch your neighbor out at the mailbox or as you're coming in and out of your house. So I think that does lead to more and more isolation.
Now, you're not necessarily promoting the exact opposite either, are you? I mean, we've all seen some of these stories about tiny houses that are being built these days. In fact, I just saw one on TV this past weekend. It was purportedly one of the smallest tiny houses this guy had ever built. It was 8 feet by 8 feet.
Wow.
I said,
wow.
You know, there's a tiny house and then there's a minuscule house. But you're not necessarily promoting that, right? Just not maybe so big.
Yeah, no, I'm not promoting that at all. You know, I'm thinking my husband's 6'2". I don't know how he'd fit in an 8 feet by 8 foot house. So, we want defining what is enough is almost a spiritual journey that we all have to go on ourselves. And I think I wrote in the book, but I've said many times, when I first started diving into what is enough for me, I lived in a very tiny house, and there was 4 of us. And I actually moved to a bigger house because I realized that our house was actually too small, and I couldn't have the people over I wanted to have over. I couldn't have my family over. I wanted my kids to have a little bit more space to grow in. And then now my children are adults, and my husband and I are back now into a smaller place. So we've expanded and contracted really based on our needs in the moment. So sometimes you might need quote unquote more of something to be enough, to be inside of enough.
We're talking, if you're joining us a couple of minutes late, listeners, on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, we're chatting with Gina LaRoche, co-author of The 7 Laws of Enough. Gina is the co-founder of 7 Stones Leadership Group. She is a leading organizational consultant, executive coach, speaker, author, artist. She has degrees from Georgetown and an MBA from Harvard Business Schools. One of the things that you talk about in your book, The 7 Laws of Enough, Gina, is taking the scare out of scarcity. Can you talk about that a little bit, Gina?
Yeah, I met a man who became my mentor. His name is Les Chavan, and one of the first words he said to me was that we are swimming in a sea of scarcity, and we don't even know it. And I remember at the time thinking that my first thought was, "That's not true. I'm a perfectly fine human being. I'm not swimming in a sea of scarcity." But when I took a step back and really saw what he was talking about and investigating this for myself, what I noticed that I spent at the time a lot of my life comparing myself to other people, and even comparing myself to myself. Well, I used to be able to run faster, or I used to weigh 10 pounds lighter, or, you know, I looked younger. And I started noticing that there were these stories that had me trapped in scarcity. And in Lynn Twist's book, The Soul of Money, she talks about 3 toxic myths of scarcity. One is that there is not enough. 2, more is better. And 3, that's just the way it is. And many of us live our life like there is not enough and more is better and there's nothing I can do about it. And Jen and I distinguish really the flip side. Not only are there 3 toxic myths of scarcity, we also have these myths of excess. And one is you can have it all. We truly believe that we can have it all. 2 is that having it all will make us happy. And finally, if you do not have it all, and or you are not happy, it is your fault. And what we hope that the readers gain from this book is to see that both the myths of scarcity and the myths of excess are exactly that, myth. And you can navigate your way out of the scarcity story through our bridge is the 7 laws. And it's a challenge in our society where, you know, we're supposed to get a new cell phone every 18 months and a new car every 2 years. And we're always supposed to get that promotion, that raise. We're always supposed to be striving. So to break free of that trap of more and accumulation is very difficult, especially on your own.
The gin that Gina mentioned is Jennifer Cohen. She's the co-author of this book, The Seven Laws of Enough. Also the co-founder, along with you, Gina, of Seven Stones Leadership Group. What's that, by the way?
Yeah. Well, we are a coaching and consulting firm, really offering transformational workshops and transformational experiences for our clients, using our work from what we've learned in this domain of enoughness, and then melding our own work from coaching, mindfulness, meditation, plus all I've learned as a business executive and from Harvard Business School. We have a nice mix of offerings, and our clients use really our practices and experiments to navigate themselves through their careers and whatever, you know, toward whatever they want for themselves, their goals and dreams.
Mm-hmm. Does everybody tell themselves these stories about scarcity and excess, and just how important are they? Is it all perception, Gina?
Well, the first law, Dave, is that stories matter, and we all tell ourselves stories. We come from stories. We have a story about our childhood. We have stories about our ancestry. We have stories about our gender, our community, our religion. So stories guide us. They shape us. They actually define us. So whether we know it or not, it's we assert that this scarcity story, particularly in the United States, but all over the world, is a part of our story, even if we don't realize it is. We have stories about money that we learned as a child. Either we don't have enough, or we have plenty of money, but don't tell anyone you have plenty of money. Keep that a secret, because then they'll try to take it away from you. So that's, you know, whether you have money or don't have money, we were told we have stories about money, which drive the stories around scarcity. And we actually say that money is one of scarcity's pain points. Money, also time. We've seen this, like, we're all so busy, busy, busy. And then the third pain point, which we chatted about a little bit, is this relationship and this lack of connection is also a scarcity pain point. But yes, I would say we do all have some story in this domain.
We'll take a quick break. We have a few more minutes to chat with our guest here on It's Your Turn, Gina LaRoche, about the seven laws of enough. We'll be back after these words.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. It's the holiday season and you're buying gifts for everyone, but not everyone lives around here anymore. So you've got to ship those gifts, and you want a local, reliable shipping company that you can trust to get that package to your loved ones. We suggest Going Postal in Butler. Going Postal, just off Newcastle Road. They'll find a way to ship just about anything. Simple, too. Just take the gift up. They pack it. They ship it. And if you want to get stocking stuffers like lottery tickets or Christmas cards, they've got those, too. They're just off Newcastle Road, right in between Villa Grande and King's Restaurant. Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping store.
Welcome back. It's the It's Your Turn program here on WISR. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Gina LaRoche, visiting with us by telephone. She's the co-author of a book entitled The Seven Laws of Enough. We've actually talked about a couple of the laws without actually defining them as such. Gina, stories matter is law number one. I am enough is law number two. Talk about some of the other ones. Number three, for example, law number three is I belong. Expand on that a little bit for us, Gina.
Yeah, so law number three is I belong, and what I'll say is you belong, full stop, period, end of story, regardless of what you tell yourself, regardless of what you look like, where you're from, you belong, and you know you're belong because you're here. We feel like if you are born into this human body, you belong regardless of the lines on the earth that we have drawn to separate ourselves and the tribes we belong to separate ourselves. You do belong. Law number four is no one is exempt. And we can't insulate ourselves from life's ups and downs. And there is freedom when we stop trying, when we stop trying to nip and tuck and buy our way out. We can find freedom when we realize that we are not exempt. Law number five is resting is required, and resting deeply in ourselves allows us to remember really the truth of the rest of the laws and find this place where we can see that life is okay regardless of what's happening. Law number six is joy is available, and this law really reminds us to lighten up, have some fun, not take things so seriously, but also reminds us that laughter and humor can also be a weapon of upset and destruction, and so there's, you know, to be careful of how we are using humor. And then law number seven, which I often say might really, truly, Dave, be the only law, is that love is the answer. Mm. So regardless of the question, regardless of the circumstance, if we can have the courage to stand from a place of love, ultimately, I think that could solve a lot of our problems.
We're talking with Gina LaRoche. Gina, what's the fallacy of the self-made person?
Oh, that, you know, we have this myth in our society that we are self-made and we should be self-made. And Horatio Alger pulled himself up by his bootstraps and went out and conquered America. And we, it's not true. If we look, Benjamin Franklin often says he's a self-made man. Even I actually saw an article in the New York Times last week how Frederick Douglass often touted himself as a self-made man. And when you look behind the curtain, even Thoreau, they talk about that, his 2 years out at Walden Pond. Like, there are people cooking, cleaning, taking care of, in Benjamin Franklin's case, his sister was home taking care of his elderly parents while he was out, quote unquote, being self-made. So we have people who are behind us, supporting us, whether we see it or not. Usually they're invisible people in our society. They've been women. They've been people of color. But somebody paved that road that you drove to work on. Somebody built the car. Somebody laid the track for the subway system. Somebody is stocking the groceries, so whenever you feel like showing up at the grocery store, there's plenty of food for you to buy. So no, we're not self-made, and we do see it as a fallacy.
You mentioned one of the laws, I think it's number five, about resting is required. We really need time mm-hmm. to kind of stand down and ponder, don't we, things that we have.
Yeah.
Not just tangible things, but intangible things as well.
Yeah, to pause. And resting to us isn't, we're not talking about sitting in front of Netflix binging the next episode of whatever, drinking a beer. We're not against that, but this kind of rest is a resting of the nervous system, stimulating positive emotional attractors through meditation, prayer, joyfulness, laughter, connection. That's the kind of rest we need. And for many of us, it is lacking.
This is important not only in family life, but heck, in the workplace as well, right, Gina?
Absolutely. These laws belong in the workplace. Like law number three, I belong. We talk a lot about diversity and inclusion in the workplace. I use that law to say, look who's in and who's out. Look who's getting promoted. Look who's getting hired. Right? Who are you inviting in? So this is definitely applicable in the workplace. Stories matter. What's your vision of the future? Where's the story of where you came from? Those are story or corporate stories, right? We all know Hewlett and Packard started in a garage. That's the story that shaped not only that company, but all of the tech industry and how we expect companies to come from nothing to succeed. So, yes, these laws can work and are applicable in the workplace.
Well, I can't think of a better time to talk about your book and these concepts than Thanksgiving time. And obviously, we're very close to the Thanksgiving season, but we really have to remember to do this year-round, don't we?
Absolutely. You know, we talk about generosity and gratitude really are the cornerstones to a life of sustainable abundance. So this Thanksgiving and all year round, this to pause and notice what you are grateful for. Notice that you woke up this morning, that the sun is shining, that you have some community. Maybe it's an animal that you can love or a friend, but just remember that. And then really being generous, looking at ways that you can tithe, and I use tithing like your money or your time toward the organizations that you love. And what does that look like? $5 for somebody could be a blessed amount of money to give away. And that helps us remember that we have enough when we say, oh, I have not an extra $5, but maybe that $5, I'm going to not have a cup of coffee so I can help someone else have a cup of coffee today. So we call them workouts in the book, but we really encourage you to practice. And each chapter of the book has a lot of practices. You don't have to do them all, but they're really there for you to pick and choose. And generosity and gratitude are woven throughout the entire book.
Our time is gone. Let me just give you one quick testimonial about this book, and it comes from Erica Fox, New York Times bestselling author. She says, "The authors are true visionaries. Their groundbreaking view of the world is equally compelling and comforting, equally inspiring as it is encouraging." The title of the book is The 7 Laws of Enough, Creating a Life of Sustainable Abundance. And it's been our pleasure to talk with one of the co-authors, along with Jennifer Cohen, Gina LaRoche, visiting with us today. Gina, a delightful take in your book. We appreciate you being with us here today.
Dave, we really appreciate you having us. Thank you.
Okay. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our hands and wrists are in motion nearly every minute of every day. So when you develop pain, everyday tasks become a problem. And although the causes of pain may vary, the orthopedic hand and upper extremity surgeons at Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers diagnose and treat a wide array of conditions. To learn more about hand and upper extremity care, visit TriRiversMSK.com or call 1-866-874-7483. Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, partnering with the Butler community for more than 20 years.
When the time comes, the last thing you need to concern yourself with is planning the funeral. It's the wrong time, your time of grieving, when your emotions come to the surface. You just can't think straight. You just can't. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler suggests that you pre-plan the funeral. Make all of the choices now while you're still emotionally able to. The funeral service, the casket, which minister, priest, or rabbi, cremation, visitations, flowers, church services or not. All of these decisions. Avoid all of that. Pre-plan now. Make those decisions now while you can think clearly and rationally. Think about it, and then talk it over with us at Thompson Miller. Call 724-287-3706, 287-3706, or www.thompson-miller.com. Pre-arrangement. It really makes sense. Thompson Miller Funeral Home at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller. Time-honored excellence.
As the Christmas season approaches, WISR looks forward to bringing the sounds of the season to our listeners and being Butler's official Christmas music station. This year, we're expanding our Christmas programming to include concerts by local churches, schools, and community choirs. At this time, we're inviting any community organization to submit a recording of their holiday concert to be included in our Christmas choir broadcasts. You can record a rehearsal or a live performance and submit it to us in MP3 format via email to info@bcrnetwork.com. We'll choose 6 performances from all those submitted to be featured in our Christmas choir broadcasts on December 15th and 22nd. Deadline to submit your recording is December 11th. WISR, your hometown station, is proud to support and broadcast local Christmas concerts this holiday season.
Welcome, listeners, on this next segment of It's Your Turn. We're going to be talking about the Statue of Liberty. Everybody knows about the Statue of Liberty, but I don't think too many people know about the history and the fascinating story behind it. Our guest joins us by telephone today. He is Edward de Berenson, professor of history and director of the Institute of French Studies and a director of the Center for International Research in Humanities and Social Sciences at New York University. Ed, nice to meet you. It's terrific to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Yeah, great to be with you.
We're talking about your book entitled The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story. As I mentioned before, Statue of Liberty, you know, you go out into the street with a microphone, everybody says, well, of course, Statue of Liberty. But then you start talking about the history, where it came from, who designed it, how it got here, and then our knowledge tends to slip a little bit. I suppose a majority of Americans might know, if they thought about it hard enough, that it came from France, and that would be about it, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. It's a bizarre thing because there's nothing more familiar than the Statue of Liberty on one level, but on the other hand, it's not all that well known.
Yeah.
And if people know that it came from France, they usually think it was a gift from the French government to the American government. And in fact, the two governments had nothing to do with it. There was no government money that went into it. The money to pay for the statue was raised completely from private sources in France. And then the American backers of the statue decided to build the pedestal, and that too was paid for completely from private donations of individual citizens. And the other thing that people in this country tend not to know is that the reason that the Statue of Liberty got built, the whole reason the French decided they wanted to give this gift, had to do with internal French politics. It was the 1860s, and France had a authoritarian regime run by Napoleon III, who was the nephew of the great Napoleon, and there were a number of influential, well-to-do people who really hated that regime because it didn't give them very much liberty. It limited their freedom of expression, and they thought the Americans had a better form of government. They basically wanted to tweak their authoritarian ruler by creating this symbol to liberty that said, the Americans have liberty and we don't.
Huh. Yeah, we tend to forget we had the American War of Independence Revolution in started in 1776. The French Revolution came shortly thereafter, but where we have been stable below these past 200 plus years, there have been many governments, different governments in France.
Yeah. There's a joke that some guy walks into a bookstore in France and said, you know, I'm interested in a copy of the French Constitution, and the answer is, well, there have been about 17 of them. You know, that in the 19th century there was a revolution in France almost every 20 years, and so it's been a very, very unstable situation. It took almost a century after the French Revolution. That took place in 1789, and it wasn't really until the 1880s that the French developed a stable democratic form of government. And so there were a number of people who thought about these sorts of things, who were interested in politics and government in France, and who wanted France to be much more like the United States, and in terms of that stability. And of course, the most famous French figure is de Tocqueville, who wrote the great book about American democracy. And one of the things he liked about America was its stability, the fact that it managed to provide liberty and order at the same time. And the French, according to Tocqueville, and a lot of people who thought about these things in France in the 19th century agreed with him, is that the French could produce liberty, but it pretty quickly went too far, and it degenerated into forms of chaos, and the liberty was never accompanied by order, and in order to establish that order, you then had to snuff out liberty. And so that was the kind of philosophy behind the symbolism of the Statue of Liberty, is that it was supposed to represent the orderly liberty that the Americans had figured out how to create and that the French had not.
Let's put a little timeline behind all of this. When was it that this small group of French intellectuals actually made the decision? First of all, did they decide it was going to be a statue or just some sort of a...
No, you know, they got together in... It was June of 1865. It was right after the assassination of President Lincoln and the North's victory. And so the reason they got together was to celebrate the victory of the North. They were opponents of slavery, and they really supported the North, but it was also to mourn the death of Abraham Lincoln, who these French intellectuals revered, and they wished that they had a leader in their country like Lincoln. So that was the original idea for them getting together, and then they started talking and thinking, and they said, well, you know, we ought to do something to show our admiration for Lincoln, our sadness over his loss, and our really positive feelings toward the United States. And there was one artist in this group, and that was the sculptor who eventually made the Statue of Liberty. His name was Frederic Bartholdi. And so they basically said, Frederic, it's up to you to think about what this gesture we want to make toward the United States, what it's going to look like. And so he sort of went home and he did some thinking, and he was a guy who wanted to build things on a colossal scale. He had traveled to Egypt. He had seen the ancient colossal statues that the ancient Egyptians had built, and he knew about the huge ancient colossi that had been built in, or at least conceived in, ancient Greece and in Rome. And so he decided that that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to build a colossal statue. And he was a really ambitious character, and he decided he was going to build the largest statue in the world, and he was going to put it in a place where everybody coming to the United States would see it, and that was going to be New York Harbor. But it took about 5 years for that idea to come together. You know, his first thought, and this is something that not that many people know, his first thought was he was actually going to build a huge colossal statue in Egypt at the opening of the Suez Canal. And it would kind of stand for the connection between Asia and Europe. But the Egyptians didn't have the money to pay for it, and so he went back to the drawing board, and right in the early 1870s decided that this is our idea. You know, we're gonna take this colossal statue that I wanted to build originally in Egypt, we're gonna put it in New York Harbor, and that's gonna be this great symbolic gesture that shows our French admiration for the American form of government and our desire for a really close relationship between the two countries.
We're talking, listeners, for those of you who may have joined us a few minutes late on this segment of It's Your Turn, we're talking with Edward Berenson, the author of a newly published book entitled The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story. It's a fascinating and little-known story, I dare say, behind the Statue of Liberty and the history of it. I'm thinking of what the first reaction of Americans might be. You know, did Bartholdi and these other guys hop on the transatlantic, newly laid transatlantic telegraph and say, hey, guess what? We have a gift for you. It's the biggest statue ever made, and we'd like to put it smack in the middle of New York Harbor. What do you think?
Yeah, you can imagine that there is some skepticism in this country. So Bartholdi actually came alone, got on a boat, crossed the Atlantic, and he gets off in New York. He doesn't speak a word of English. He doesn't know anybody. He's got some good contacts, so he's got some letters of introduction to important people. He doesn't know anybody, but he goes to some of his contacts, and he says, you know, I have this idea. I want to show how much we admire your form of government. I want to do that by creating this gigantic statue. I'm going to decide what the statue is going to look like. I'm going to decide how it's built. I'm going to decide where it goes. All you have to do is to give me a place to put it for free. people looked at them crosswise and they said, you know, what is this? And, you know, you just think about it. If somebody comes up to you and says, you know, I want to really give you this great gift for free, you know, you're going to wonder, well, what do they want in return?
Yeah.
You know, what's their ulterior motives? And, you know, there actually were some sort of ulterior motives. I mean, it was for the most part a very friendly gesture, or at least it was meant as a friendly gesture, but the ulterior motives were that these French political and intellectual types who were behind the idea, they were worried that the United States and France were drawing apart. Napoleon III had supported the South in the Civil War, so he had supported the losing side. And once the Civil War was over and the Union was reestablished, that these French people were afraid that the new President Grant would punish France for the support of the South. And as the American economy grew and the German economy grew, there were many more connections economically between the United States and Germany than there were between the United States and France. And so these French people were worried about that too. They were afraid of a kind of separation, both on a political level and an economic level, between the two countries. And so one of the things they wanted to do in creating this great gift to the United States is to remind the Americans that the French had played a crucial role in the American Revolution, and to tell us here that, well, maybe you guys wouldn't even exist as an independent country if it hadn't been for us.
Yeah.
And that we want you to remember that, and we want to have a strong relationship with you. So there were some kind of ulterior motives, and so that's one reason why there was a certain amount of skepticism. And then beyond that, Bartholdi said, look, we're going to pay for the statue, but we need you to pay for the pedestal, you Americans to pay for the pedestal.
That's the next part of the story. I want to take a quick break here. We have a few more minutes left to chat with our guest, Edward Berenson. But a quick break first for a message or two, and we'll be back to continue our conversation on the Statue of Liberty, a transatlantic story, here on It's Your Turn on WISR. Back right after these words.
If you're curious, the news informs you, but it also piques your curiosity. Enter The Context, a free weekday morning newsletter from PA Post. PA Post is the statewide nonprofit and nonpartisan news organization reporting on public policy issues in the state. The Context ties together compelling stories from across Pennsylvania with insight and perspective and points your curiosity in a meaningful direction. Start your subscription today at papost.org.
Your daughter looks up to you. She loves that you love soccer. You're her MVP. Together, you can take on underage drinking. From ages 8 through 11, kids are most open to parents' messages about alcohol. So learn the facts and defend her against the harms of alcohol. Take your best shot at underage drinking, one-on-one. Talk with your kids about alcohol. Learn more at knowwhennowhow.org. A message from the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board.
Midday lottery numbers for today. The big two, or pick two, is 64, 64. Pick three, 429, 429. Pick four, 9193. Pick five, 93804. Wild ball for each of those is one. The treasure hunt is 5, 13, 16, 23, and 29. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
Welcome back, listeners. Nice to have you with us on this segment of It's Your Turn today. Dave Malarkey is my name. We're talking about a book published by Edward Berenson, who is visiting with us by telephone today. The book is titled The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story. We've talked about Bartholdi, the man who designed it, and we're going to talk about the podium on which it stands in just a moment. But there's another name that people would recognize, a man by the name of Gustav Eiffel, famous for the Eiffel Tower, of course. How did he get involved? I'm guessing that there was some engineering, complex engineering questions about this statue.
Yeah, this was really a great marvel of engineering, because there's a lot of wind in the New York Harbor, and so a huge, colossal statue has to be able to absorb that wind. And the main structures that were able to do that in the 19th century were bridges. And Gustav Eiffel was the greatest bridge builder of his time. And so the sculptor Bartoldi recruited Gustav Eiffel to create the skeleton that holds the Statue of Liberty up. You know, if you look at it, you might think, well, it's a solid thing. It's a statue. But it's actually way too big to be a solid structure. And so what it is this incredibly thin wafer of copper, that the copper is heated up and then molded, and then it's hammered to the thinness of about a penny. The skin of the Statue of Liberty is just a little bit thicker than a penny, and it hangs on this very elaborate wrought iron structure that holds the thing up and ingeniously allows it to move with the wind and to respond to the changes in temperature so that it could stand there stably in New York Harbor. And the material that the skeleton that holds up the copper skin is made out of is the same material that Eiffel a couple of years later would use to build the Eiffel Tower. And in fact, what you've got inside the Statue of Liberty is a little Eiffel Tower.
It's an amazing bit of history. Well, let's talk about the podium now, because if you missed the beginning of our conversation with Ed Berenson, there was no government money involved here, either France or the U.S., so I'm assuming we had to have some sort of a private fundraising, or at least gathering of rich people who decided they were going to pay for the podium to put this thing on?
Yeah. There were some attempts to get some money. There was a bill before Congress to put up $100,000, which then in the 1870s was a lot more money than it is now, and Congress voted it down. And then there was a bill in the New York legislature to put up $50,000 to pay for the pedestal, and then Governor Grover Cleveland vetoed the bill. So, yeah, you're right. A group of rich New Yorkers got together, and they were the members of an elite club. It still exists. It's called the Union League Club, and they were brought together bankers and industrialists, and they said, okay, we're gonna raise this money. And they had a really hard time doing it because the ordinary citizens said, well, you know, these guys are so wealthy. Why don't they just pay for it? Why should we have to pay for it? And so they had a really, really hard time coming up with the money, and the person who came to the rescue was the great newspaper publisher Joseph Pulitzer, who ran the New York World, which was kind of a populist newspaper. And Pulitzer looked at this situation. He said, wow, I can really accomplish two things. He believed in the message of the Statue of Liberty. He himself was an immigrant and had made his fortune in the United States, and believed in the value of American liberty. And so he really wanted to see the Statue of Liberty go up, but he also realized that if he got behind a fundraising campaign for the pedestal, he could sell a lot more newspapers. And in fact, he quadrupled his circulation. And what he did is he told his readers, he said, look, send in your nickels, dimes, quarters, I don't care how small it is, any contribution you send in, I'm going to put your name in the paper. And if you send a letter in, I may even publish that letter, or at least parts of it. And this was mostly just regular people, working people, office workers, clerks, factory workers, and they weren't the kind of people who were very likely to see their names in the paper. And they liked the idea of liberty. And Pulitzer, because he was kind of a populist, he used a rhetoric that we would be familiar with nowadays. He didn't use these terms, but he basically said, my readers represent the 99%, and there's a 1% out there, and they could pay for it, but they're not going to. So let's show these wealthy people who probably don't really believe very much in liberty that we do believe in liberty and that we'll pay for that pedestal. And it worked.
How did our time begins to grow short? Our listeners, we're talking with Edward Berenson, author of The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story. How in the name of heaven did they ever get it over here from France?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Because how ingeniously it's built, it's like a gigantic erector set, if you remember that thing that some of us played with as kids. But it's a modular design, and you can take the thing apart. So the whole thing was first built in Paris, and it took several years to put it up. And the copper skin is basically 300 sheets of copper that are riveted together. And so they took the rivets out, and they dismantled it. They numbered all the pieces. They did the same thing with the iron skeleton. They were all numbered. They put them in 212 shipping containers, took them by train to the port in Normandy, put them on a boat, took a couple of weeks for that boat to cross the Atlantic, and then they unloaded these 212 shipping containers on what was then called Bedloe's Island, a tiny little island in New York Harbor. Now, of course, it's called Liberty Island. And those crates sat there unopened for a year while they waited for the Americans to raise the money to put up the pedestal.
Amazing. Obviously, listeners, much more detail on these things. We're just scratching the surface in Ed's book, The Statue of Liberty. Was it called the Statue of Liberty from the beginning? I know that the French have, there's a famous painting I can remember standing in front of it in the Louvre, Delacroix. I think it's called Liberty Leading the People. Do the French people tend to personify liberty? Did they name it?
Well, their original name was Liberty Enlightening the World.
Ah.
That was the original name, and they actually thought about modeling it after the Delacroix painting, but these French backers thought that imagery in Delacroix was a little too radical. It represented the radical French Revolution, and they liked the more moderate form of liberty, at least to them, that seemed preferable. And so that they then turned to other kinds of female goddesses of liberty that represented what they saw as the marriage between liberty and order, which is what they liked about the United States. And so they had not the sort of flowing, kind of flaming liberty that you see in the Delacroix painting, but a much more staid image.
Do you talk about Emma Lazarus in your book, Edward Berenson?
She was part of the fundraising effort. That one of the things that the American backers did to come up with money was they asked leading artists and writers to contribute a work and then auction it off and use that money to help finance the pedestal. And so that's the origins of the great poem, the New Colossus, Give Me Your Tired, Your Poor, Your Huddled Masses. She wrote it as a donation for the fundraising effort.
Wow.
But kind of surprisingly, and this is something that I didn't know until I started doing research for the book, that poem was forgotten for over 20 years after she wrote it. And it really didn't get associated kind of really closely with the Statue of Liberty until the 1930s, about 50 years after Emma Lazarus wrote that poem. That's when it got really put front and center, and it really came to define the meaning of the Statue of Liberty. The statue really wasn't about immigration at first. That was Emma Lazarus's brilliant idea, but it really took a long time for it to catch on.
I can remember memorizing that in high school.
Yeah. It's a incredibly moving poem, and it really shows one of the really wonderful things about our country, which is that although immigration, of course, has been controversial, we've managed to allow and to welcome here and to integrate vast numbers of people from all over the world, and that's what that poem was all about. And it was basically Emma Lazarus's poem that turned the Statue of Liberty into a symbol of welcome to all kinds of people from abroad. That was not the original idea at all that the French creators of the Statue of Liberty had.
Bring me your tired, your poor. I hope I remember this correctly. Bring these, the tempest tossed to me, and then the great line, I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
Yeah, and using the word I, what Emma Lazarus did, who she really was a great poet, what she did is she gave the Statue of Liberty a voice. In that poem, the Statue of Liberty speaks. I lift my lamp. And I think that was one of the things that helped make the Statue of Liberty such a popular icon, is that she almost seemed to come alive thanks to the great artistry of Emma Lazarus. She took this inanimate object that's made out of copper and iron, and she seemed to give it a life, to give it a voice, to give it a personality, to make her really represent who we are as a country.
And it continues to evolve. I mean, who can forget the incredible images on TV, the Statue of Liberty, with the background of the terrorist attacks on 9/11? I mean, it's just burned into your brain.
Yeah, I mean, those are extraordinary images where you see the smoking towers from the point of view of the Statue of Liberty. And And I think that since 9/11, because of that, the Statue of Liberty has taken on yet another meaning, and it really kind of stands for the resilience of the United States and of New York City in the face of these terrible attacks. And it basically says, you know, you can't damage our liberty. It stands here. You may damage our buildings, and you may unfortunately be able to murder a lot of people, but one thing that you can't do is to snuff out liberty. And so I think that that's a new meaning that the Statue of Liberty has, or at least a renewed meaning, and that is just really the staying power, the resilience of liberty. And in fact, the architect who was in charge of rebuilding the whole World Trade Area, he was an immigrant, came to this country, that's Daniel Libeskind, in the 1950s, and he says in a number of interviews, he says that when his conception of the new Liberty Tower that he was going to build really had to do with the Statue of Liberty. He wanted the two to face each other, and he wanted his new tower to stand for liberty just like the statue does.
Well, it's a wonderful story. It's a great read. The book is called The Statue of Liberty, a Transatlantic Story, and lots of photographs and engravings of old lithographs in here, too. It's been our pleasure to chat with the author, Edward Berenson. Ed, nice to meet you. Terrific to have you with us here today.
Thanks. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care.
So long now.
Bye.
It's never been more important to stay in touch with the events and issues that shape our world. And for more than 25 years, Radio Pennsylvania has been the Commonwealth's source for stories and newsmakers impacting your life.
We're taking precautions to prepare for the worst that this storm can deliver.
And I believe that we need an armed, highly trained security officer in every school.
We should not be using mental illness as a scapegoat for things like mass shootings and violence.
Covering your state capital and all corners of the Commonwealth, Radio PA's team of award-winning journalists is on constant watch as your eyes and ears on the front lines of the major events of our time. Honored for broadcasting and journalistic excellence by
the Associated Press, the Pennsylvania Association of Broadcasters, the National Association of State Radio Networks, the National Headliner Awards, and many others.
8-time winner of the Joe Snyder Award for Outstanding News Service, the top news honor bestowed by the Associated Press in Pennsylvania. The Radio Pennsylvania Network, bringing you closer to Harrisburg and all of your Keystone State.
Well, some interesting tidbits of history about the Statue of Liberty there, and appropriate to talk about that with Ed Berenson on this Veterans Day observed. Veterans Day actually was yesterday, of course, but it's being observed today. And we had still some sunshine for the parade in downtown Butler, which was mid-morning today. Sun is pretty much gone now. Clouds have taken over, although I just checked the radar, and it still appears that any precip, chilly rain is not going to be getting into our area until sometime this evening, maybe around 8 o'clock or so. Keep an eye on the radar for you on that. And then overnight tonight, chilly rain mixed with snow showers, and we're looking at that here and there through the day tomorrow as well, although fortunately little or no accumulation is expected. Nonetheless, we can get slick spots. We certainly saw that on Saturday, didn't we, Saturday morning. All it took was freezing temperatures and even a little bit of snow, barely a coating, and gusty winds, and boy, we had a lot of icy conditions. So keep an eye on that if you're going to be driving overnight tonight or first thing tomorrow morning when we get back to a normal schedule. Schools will be open again, and everything will be back to normal tomorrow after the Veterans Day holiday today. Speaking of which, Natili North Restaurant doing something really nice. That's Natili North on North Main Street downtown. They're offering veterans 10% off their bill today and tomorrow. What a nice gesture. Also, last chance to take advantage of the Veterans Day sale at Miller's Shoes downtown, 215 South Main Street. They're open until 5 today, so you can stop in and take advantage of the Veterans Day sale. This is the final day for it. 20% off the original price of shoes, boots, and slippers through 5 p.m. today. And that includes their entire stock of Hush Puppies for men and women, Timberland shoes and boots, 20% off, Rockport shoes, 20% off,
the entire stock of men's and women's slippers. Where do you buy slippers these days? Miller Shoes, that's where. And they've got Daniel Green and Foam Treads and Lamo. Also 20% off athletic shoes, and Miller's has all your famous name brands. Nike and New Balance and Saucony and Rockport and Keds and Easy Spirit and Proped and more. All right there. Miller Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. Open till 5 today, the final day for their Veterans Day sale. I do want to mention before we check the news here, we're coming up on the top of the hour. We have a book talk coming up 2 weeks from today. And Cheryl Ferrero from Mars Area Public Library will be with us to talk about Lincoln's last trial. You know, Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer before he became president, and his last trial was as a defendant in a murder case, defended a man accused of murder. Interesting. Did you know that? I didn't know that. Well, if you want to take a read before we talk about it, Lincoln's last